So we're starting off this afternoon with Hans and Ian and Hugh and Yale talking about the activities of the ISB and the Foundation. So Hans, are you going to kick off on this?
Yes, thank you, Joanna. First, a couple of comments on our technical work program. Staff has told me that we will be able to finish our deliberations on the substance of the insurance standard in November, and that we will be able to finish all deliberations in December of this year, which is, of course, very good news. And then we will have 2016 to draft the standard. We will need that year to do so. And that means that the mandatory effective date of the new insurance contract standards will be after the 1st of January 2018, because insurance companies will need at least 3 years for implementation. And that means that the implementation date will be later than that of IFRS 9, which is 1st of January 2018. So we were aware and are aware that this could be a problem for the insurance industry, and we have therefore considered some transition relief. One thing that we already decided was, at least tentatively decided, was to give the option of an overlay approach in IFRS 4. And this overlay approach would permit an insurance company to adjust its profit or loss account to remove from profit or loss the effect of newly measuring financial assets at fair value as a result of IFRS 9. In addition to that, we have also proposed a deferral of the effective date for IFRS 9 for all insurance companies that whose activities are predominantly insurance. And we have defined it as around 70, at least 75% of its liabilities should be insurance liabilities. So this is a deferral at the entity level because we feel that deferral below the entity level, which would accommodate insurance companies that are part of a bank or the other way around, we believe that deferral below the entity level would be very confusing to users and would also necessitate rather complex rules regarding transfers between these sub-entities. The expectation is that 65% of insurers would qualify for deferral, at least in Europe. For those who have followed our discussions, they can know that it was a close call in the board to decide for this deferral. We actually had a 7-7 vote, and for the first time in my existence as chairman, I had to exercise my casting vote, which was a fantastic feeling. finally felt that it was truly important.
I tried to hide it from him.
Then a couple of words on leases. You know, we concluded our redeliberations in March 2015. The staff has worked very hard to finish the standard, almost done. We published an update on the definition of last week on the definition of a lease, which is the area of the standard that requires most judgment. To help preparers prepare for the new standard. The standard is currently expected to be issued in the course of next month, and we will certainly do so. We have decided to set an effective date of the 1st of January 2019. Just a few words on the conceptual framework. We, as you know, we published an ED in May 2015. We originally proposed a comment period of 150 days, which is 30 days longer than our standard period of 120 days, because of the length and the complexity of the conceptual framework. Nevertheless, in recent months, we have received quite a few requests from jurisdiction to extend the 150 days even further by 1 or 2 months. And ultimately, we decided in September to extend the comment period by another 30 days, so we go to 180 days, which is almost half a year. This means that the ambitious goal that we set at the beginning of this project to finish the exposure, the conceptual framework in 3 years, that cannot be attained any longer. Our constituents need more time. And in itself, that's not a big disaster, but you know, I think it would be useful for your council to look more profoundly at our the question: how long do we take for projects? Because this is going to be another multi-year project. When do we get things done? It takes a long, long time, and part of it is simply the price you pay for being a global standard setter. Documents need to be translated. That takes time. They need to be disseminated. We need to go to travel all around the world to talk to people, but what is enough? And that's perhaps something that the Advisory Council could advise us on at a certain date. Just a couple of words on our engagement strategy. We are really pleased to report that our work with the Investors in Financial Reporting Program has continued, and that 4 new organizations have joined this program in October 2015. Aberdeen Asset Management, Caisse de Dépôt et Placement du Québec, Insight Investment, and Ontario Teachers Pension Plan. So we have now 14 high-profile investor organizations in the program, and others from Japan and the UK and China are still showing interest. So I believe this is really good to bolster our relations with the investor community. This morning, we have already talked on some occasions about the further spread of IFRS in around the world. And I would really like to underline how positive developments in Asia are, especially among the 3 big economies. Japan, it needs no further clarification. Goro explained very well how extremely fast movements are going in Japan, and I would not be surprised that within a couple of years the tipping point IFRS use in Japan will be reached, and it will become the dominant accounting language over there. India has also made massive progress in adopting their new Indian accounting standards, which are largely based on IFRS it sounds scary at the beginning, with 7 carve-outs, but then you should know that of those 7 carve-outs, 5 of them are voluntary, so they can be avoided, and that 2 of the carve-outs, one of them will be temporary, it's a grandfathering solution or foreign exchange bonds, and the second one is really very small. So I would not be surprised that a lot of Indian companies, if they were allowed to assert dual compliance, that they would be able to assert compliance with IFRS. So big step forward, and in Paul Pector's overview of the progress that's made in the world, they will probably get the same status as China, as being largely substantially converged. Which brings me to China. We had, as Michel already told you, a very productive meeting there, and we hope to issue very soon a joint press release with the Chinese in which the Chinese will reassert their commitment to make further progress towards the adoption of IFRS. So this is all truly quite remarkable progress in Asia. I was planning to say a little bit about the report that I wrote with Michel Prada. He has already done so this morning. For those of you who haven't read it yet, I do recommend. I have found that a lot of people find it very useful to be able to react to the usual criticisms that the IFRS Foundation gets from critical people. Of course, it's good that there are critical people, but some of the criticism is just nonsense, and this document really helps in putting things right. These are my introductory comments.
Any questions or comments for Hans on those introductory comments? No?
Yes.
Yes? Peter. Sorry, missed you, Peter.
Yeah, just a quick one actually, Hans. You talked about the expansion of the number of investors involved in your formal program. Do you have a target number? Because we've been trying to market it quite actively, and I don't know if you want 20 or 30 or 40, or whether the number itself makes a difference, whether it's the diversity of people. If you could tell a little bit more, then we can have a bit more guidance as to who to approach.
I'm not aware of any target number. It's especially the quality of the institutions that we get on board that is really important. And we've got some big names there now. And there are quite a few pension schemes there. One of the reason why I wrote this report was in reaction to a fit of anger that I had when I read a totally misguided study that had been commissioned by the European Parliament about the ISB. And in that study, it said that we were basically a private organization that privileged commercial interests, commercial investors. And what this program makes clear that we, are very keen on talking to investors who represent the interests of very ordinary citizens around the world, such as these asset management companies and the pension funds. So in that sense, it's also a very important program.
Jake.
Thank you. Hans, I appreciate the request for feedback from this group about the speed of standard setting and when enough is enough. What is the appropriate time? I mean, I think I'd be tempted to broaden that question out slightly and say what else can be done to make the standard setting process even more effective and efficient. The sense I get is that IFRS 9 was sort of finalised, then opened up a couple of times. And are there lessons to be learnt from that? Are there lessons to be learnt from leasing and the scope of that? Is it going to deal with lessee accounting, lessor and lessee accounting, and really just broadening that up to say, well, what can we learn about the
sure.
standard setting process and how can we make it even better?
Yeah. Excellent.
Olaf?
I'd just like to say we, from the insurance industry, obviously we welcome very much the progress on IFRS 9 meeting the needs in terms of simultaneous implementation through either deferral or the overlay process. But I think we do have concerns, as you may be aware, about the scope. The 65% you mentioned is something that we will be engaging with you on, because I think there are ways of achieving a more appropriate outcome.
Okay. We look forward to that. I only would like to tell you that this was already a close call in the board because many board members thought that we had done enough with the overlay approach and were really worried about one industry being exempt from a very important standard which contains a lot of improvements and the lack of comparability that you get in the field. So will be the arguments for change will have to be very convincing, unless, of course, you want to bring the percentage back to like 50-40%, then it might be easier.
Anything further, Pants? Hugh, perhaps for your technical update then?
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd start with a very important point, which is my Scottish perspective on the rugby. And I was looking at this final, and I was looking at the name of the captain, Richie McCaw. And I was thinking, he must be Scottish. He's not a Kiwi. He must be Scottish. I looked him up and I found his family is indeed Scottish.
Well, you have to remember that actually New Zealand is a very young country, so everybody comes from somewhere.
Anyway, my reflection was, had he been a loyal Scotsman and stayed with Scotland, that very narrow defeat that Scotland suffered to Australia could have been Scotland's victory, and we would today be celebrating Scotland's
And
World
isn't
Cup.
It amazing, all the excuses that every other country comes up with.
Anyway, I thought I'd start with a few words on our transition resource groups, and you probably know that we have one on revenue and one on impairment, just the impairment pillar of IFRS 9. In relation to revenue, I think we have a sense that the various issues that have been raised from various quarters are now coming to a close. There is a meeting next Monday. There are only four issues that have been tabled for next Monday's revenue TRG. And as I say, we have a sense that they're really winding up, and that therefore we're not going to get a lot more activity. And I think that's very positive news from our point of view, because it is important that there is a degree of stability at this point. And I think one could say a similar or sketch a similar story in relation to impairment. There will be another meeting this year on impairment, but again, the volume of issues is coming down. There has not been at any point a possibility or any thought that we would reopen IFRS 9 to reflect any particular points, and Sue Lloyd has always been very clear and strong on that. And therefore, I think that that group is very much serving its purpose in the sense that it's enabling people to submit issues, to have the discussion, to figure out which bits of the standard are relevant and how the board felt that each of these issues should be thought about under IFRS 9. I think both of them will likely not be formally closed. I think they will both be out there until the effective dates of each of these standards. But I think we now need some stability, and I think that is what we're feeling in terms of the issues coming through. And also, I mean, just generally on transition resource groups, since I know it's been a topic that's been discussed more than once in this forum, and certainly for those who are new, we don't have a practice of establishing a transition resource group whenever we produce a new standard. They're very much case by case. And I think Hans was just talking about leases, and the board needs to opine, but I think it is unlikely that we will set up a TRG for leases, and then we'll have to see for insurance. So that was the TRGs. On other matters which Hans has not already spoken to, I want to say a few words about the disclosure initiative. The disclosure initiative, just a recap, it's all about effective disclosure. It's about encouraging preparers to adopt behaviours which result in effective disclosure. There are a lot of different strands to the disclosure initiative, but we have recently published one element of it, which is a draft materiality practice statement. It's a short document, I guess around 20 pages, but it basically walks through how the board thinks about materiality. I think it will be more useful in some jurisdictions than others, is my sense of it. I think in particular on this subject, we have at times suffered, I'm not sure is the right word, but the way in which we use certain words have been taken in very different ways in different countries. So when we use language like an entity shall disclose, some jurisdictions have read that to mean regardless of whether it's material or not. And that isn't what the board means, and this materiality practice statement makes that absolutely clear. It's already clear, actually, in IAS1, but anyway, it reinforces that point. And in general, it gives a lot more context about how the board thinks about materiality, both in the context of the primary financial statements, but also in the context of notes. And we've done that piece of work because when the discussion forum on disclosure, which launched this whole disclosure initiative back in January 2013, that was one of the points that came back. People told us we don't really understand the concept of materiality and how it should be applied in IFRS. So that draft statement is out there, and obviously we look forward to comments back. The cornerstone of this disclosure initiative is the so-called principles of disclosure, and there'll be a discussion paper coming out on principles of disclosure early next year. And that is quite a wide-ranging document. It's actually more wide-ranging than perhaps its title suggests, because it also touches on things like alternative performance measures. It will touch on briefly on things like communication. It will touch on a number of different things which are relevant to this thing, effective disclosure. So look out for that. Just to give a little bit of a sense of generally where we're going on disclosure, sometimes hear this feedback on the disclosure, there are so many strands and so many threads, what does it all add up to and where's it going? What it will ultimately mean, I think, is further amendments to IS1 and probably IS7 and 8 as well. And on top of that, we're going to have this materiality practice statement, we're going to have something which is some kind of statement which is enabling the board or giving the board some criteria to think about when drafting disclosures in standards. And then the last piece of it is likely to be some targeted amendments on particular standards where disclosures are considered to be challenging. So they will be things like IFRS 3, IFRS 2, the standard on post-employment benefits, IS 19. So there are certain standards where disclosures are harder than others, and we consistently get feedback. I think it is possible, depending on how we frame our objectives. We've been working with the New Zealanders to figure out better ways of generically how do we frame disclosure objectives, and New Zealand colleagues have been doing some great work in that area. And it might mean we build those words into every standard. I don't know. We're not there yet. But I think generally this is where that project is going. So that's disclosure. You say a few words about macro, the accounting for dynamic risk management, as it's sometimes called, or its other name, the macro hedge accounting project. If you remember, we published a discussion paper on that in, I think it was April of last year. We've had a lot of feedback. I think it was nearly 130 comment letters came back from a whole mix of people, a whole mix of constituents. And the feedback was, I think fair to say, not it was mixed. I think users, and if you had to characterize, and you can't really do this, but a very broad brush characterization would be users want one thing and preparers are willing to do another. And so I think we're at a point where the board has said, look, let's really figure out what the information requirements of users are in this area. And armed with that information, let's go and figure out what the disclosure and recognition and measurement, obviously, requirements should be. So that's where that project is going. I think my personal view, I think it's a tough project, because I think when you look at different banks' policies on their risk management of NII, and that's really what this thing is all about, people are doing different things. And so to have one accounting standard which fits all is quite a challenge. So we'll see where we go with macro. Rate-regulated activities is slightly strange project in the sense that although the next output is going to be a discussion paper, it is already sitting on the standard-setting major project agenda. And the reason for that is we know that some standard-setting is inevitable at some point, and that's because the current standard is an interim standard. So we will have to do something to sort out what is an interim standard at this point. So rate-regulated activities is moving along, and as I say, the next output will be discussion paper, and I think a lot of attention is still going on that. Also in your update, you will see some summary words on our research agenda, and I just wanted to say a few words about the research programme. And actually, to Jake's point, Jake was saying, what can we learn about doing standard setting better? This is one of the key answers, actually, but it's only been around for, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years. The reason, the whole point of having the research program at all is to focus on this thing of evidence-based decision-making, evidence-based standard setting. It is designed to address, if people say to us, well, why did you have multiple exposure drafts for leases or whatever it was, people would then say, well, maybe you didn't have haven't figured out precisely what your end state was or precisely what your target objective was in going to standard setting. So the point of the research program is exactly to do that. It is to figure out what is the problem that we're trying to fix before we actually try to fix it. And while some people might say, well, that's just adding another layer and more time to standard setting, it's actually intended to be much more to actually shorten the standard setting life cycle, because it's designed to make an effective straight line to move through research and then onto standard setting. Assuming we even want to move out of research. I mean, one outcome of a research project might be that we don't move to standard setting. We conclude that there is no need for standard setting. So that, I think, is one significant element or significant answer to Jake's observation just a few minutes ago. If you look at our research program, you will see there are a lot of projects. That's why I gave the task to Peter Clark. You can look after all those projects. No, joking aside, I think we have a challenge, and it's something we're thinking about very carefully within the agenda consultation, and we're going to be staring very hard at the feedback that comes from the agenda consultation, because it almost has this natural, inexorable growth to it as well, our research program. And it grows for different reasons, but one is we now do have, or have a program of doing post-implementation reviews, and as a result of a post-implementation review, one outcome might be a research project, and that's happened in the case of business combinations. So it grows because of post-implementation reviews, and it can grow for other reasons. It can grow because the board decides it wants something to be put on the agenda, or for several different reasons, really. But I guess the challenge that we have is, how many projects can we realistically attend to and expect the world to be able to absorb all of that output? And as I was saying earlier, Joanne made the comment, I think it's not so much the capacity of the staff to produce the output as much as it is the world to absorb a very large number of new standards. And so we've got some, I think, difficult decisions to make when we come to the agenda consultation. And as I say, we're paying very careful attention to the feedback, because when you look at the subjects in there, they're not trivial subjects in many cases. They're really big, contentious, very meaty subjects. So there are things like the distinction between debt and equity. They are things like post-employment benefits and how we deal with, particularly how we deal with hybrid schemes, but it's not just that. They are things like income tax, a standard which we get lots of feedback on, but if you're going to do a fundamental review of it, what would you do? We've got share-based payments in there. People often make the link to the debt equity research project as well, saying that there should be a degree of logic between these two standards. And we're aware of lots of practice difficulties in the area of share-based payments. And I think, as well, one project I would highlight, and I think we will, well, I know from outreach meetings where we've had a lot of feedback on this, we have a topic which is now being called primary financial statements. That is a renamed project. It used to be called performance reporting, but it is the project in which we look at the structure of financial statements and how they link with each other. So that's a project where users have given us a lot of feedback, and I'm sure we will get the feedback this time. And I would be candid in saying we probably haven't done enough since the first agenda consultation in picking that topic up. So the end result of all of that is, though, we've got lots of big subjects, lots of big topics, and of course, every single topic on there is extremely important to somebody. So how do you prioritise them? And I think the comment was made earlier, and I'll repeat it, there are also going to be people writing to us in the feedback to the agenda consultation saying, here's a new topic we would like you to look at. And I think what we've said in the request for views is, if you want to put a new topic on, you have to take something off because of this capacity point. So I think the research program is, doing a lot of really good work. It is also a program that we need to look at very carefully to make sure that we get the right balance between how much we do and how much we give the world. I'm slightly looking forward to tomorrow's agenda consultation, but I guess this is the point I really want to stress today and tomorrow, because it is important. The last thing that you have in your technical update pack is a whole appendix, Appendix B, on our IFRIC, our Interpretations Committee issues. I wasn't planning to walk through all the issues, but I was going to make some general comments. If you look at what's in that appendix, you'll see there's quite a lot of topics. And one of the bits of feedback we get is, are we tinkering too much with our standards? Are we doing too much to meddle with some of the finer details of our standards? One aspect about these various topics that you see is that we're at the kind of a little bit the end of a certain life cycle. Right now, the new topics coming on and the new agenda decisions being made are much fewer than they were 18 months, 2 years ago. And it's the decisions made 18 months, 2 years ago, which you're now seeing in terms of final documents going out of the door. But those final documents, or the volume of the final documents going out of the door, is going to ease off because we, as I say, the volume of agenda decisions, the volume of new interpretation decisions has come down a lot. What we do have an issue with is what we sometimes call NIFRICs, which are these agenda decisions purporting to, or which make clear that there isn't a need for changes in the actual standard. And there's quite a high volume of these so-called NIFRICs. And, of course, people sometimes will say, well, it's a bit of a challenge to ask people to look at all these NIFRICs when they're not changing the words of the standard. And how much do we expect preparers and others to pay attention to this kind of parallel literature that exists? And I think that is a challenge as well. So I think, and again, it's a question that we ask in the agenda consultation, do we have the balance right in terms of the work that goes on at the Interpretations Committee? So I think it's an area where we will be looking again very carefully at the feedback that comes through on the agenda consultation. I think that was all I wanted to say, Joanna.
All right. Thank you, Hugh. And obviously a number of those matters that you've raised, particularly at the end, are actually coming through from the agenda consultation. So, you know, the future of the research topics and the Interpretations Committee, et cetera, and as you say, the NOIFRICs. And I find it fascinating that you talk about the literature. From my time on the Interpretations Committee, you know, the emphasis was that is not part of the literature, and you've just very clearly said it is part of the literature.
When I say that, in the sense that everything with 30 Cannon Street on it, by some people, is considered to be our literature. Now you can debate the official.
And I think that is exactly true. We can kid ourselves, and I think we did, and you've just been pragmatic. Actually, it is part of the literature, but how do we get people to actually understand it? So I think that is a big question. And obviously the research and the prioritisation of the research, and you raised the comment, how you prioritise is important. And my question back is, well, how do we prioritise and how should we prioritise? So perhaps a little bit of discussion around that tomorrow. I have one question, and I probably should know the answer to this, and it's to do with the disclosure initiative. And I guess, you know, the progress that you're making and the release last week of that materiality draft materiality practice statement, what is, and I'm looking at here as well because I'm interested in views from the council, what is the general perception in the marketplace with our stakeholders around what we're doing on, or you're doing on, the disclosure initiative? Do people think it's going far enough? Are they waiting in anticipation and they're going to be disappointed? Do they think you're spot on with what you're doing?
I would summarise it like this, and then I'll be interested to hear what people say. First of all, I think there is a high degree of unanimity that this is an important project. I don't think anybody doubts that. I think, second of all, is it moving fast enough and deep enough? Interestingly, actually, I just wrote an article on this and quoted Hans. Hans gave a speech in 2013 called Breaking the Boilerplate. It had 10 points in it. If you look at our progress against these 10 points, we've done something like 7.5 or 8 of them. So against that benchmark, we're moving well. I think, though, that the... And this is where I would acknowledge we have important work still to do, let's say, and it's also why I think it's important that we make clear what our roadmap is at this point, and I sort of slightly hinted that we need to do that. I think constituents do expect there to be something substantive to come out of this standard-by-standard review of disclosures. Now, I think that we need to be a little bit careful how we manage that, because this exercise has already been done. It was done by the Scottish Institute and the New Zealand Institute in that report, Losing the Excess Baggage. And that report didn't come up with so many disclosures that you can just get rid of. And the reason is, most of the disclosures in our standards are there for a reason, and they will be important for some entities at certain points in time.
That report came up with a lot of proposals for getting rid of disclosures, but I think a lot of people, including the board, didn't like that, much. That was the real problem.
There's that too. And I just think it's hard, you know, to get rid of disclosures which have been put in there for good reason after lengthy deliberation by the board. The thing that we're really trying to get to is behavioural change. And behavioural change, you ask the question, how easy is it for a standard setter to facilitate behavioural change? It's an interesting question. I think that I am very optimistic because we do see developments. I mean, there's the some of the developments in Australia and I think in New Zealand as well on streamlining. And we see companies in the UK, and I'm sure you can find examples across the world, of companies who are really taking up that point that you were making earlier, Joanna, that about reports need to be more tools of communication and not a detailed report on compliance. I think that it's still hard because the volume is very big. I know HSBC's biggest filing is about 1,000 pages long. Your SEC filing is about 1,000 pages long. So it's quite difficult to tell a story when your document is that long.
It's a novel.
It's War and Peace or something like that. Yeah. So I think there are, I think there are different. There's a different piece to this, which we will probably come to. It's a little bit something that we would have touched on in the structure and effectiveness review, or we will be. And it's things like use of technology and how we communicate. And if you think, in 100 years' time, we'll be still using 500-page reports, we won't be. What's the thing going to be? Who knows? But it'll be different.
All right. Thank you, Hugh. And I raised a couple of questions there with him. Other people have questions or any observations on what you perceive to be around the disclosure initiative? Garth.
Do you mind if I spread it beyond the disclosure initiative?
Absolutely, yeah. Go for it.
I was just wanting to ask in relation to the transition resource groups. The guidance says you're not going to issue guidance, so why submit anything? Do you give feedback to those that submit them? That's the first thing. Secondly, you sense that the number of queries coming through is reducing. I would be saying, well, shouldn't you be expecting a larger number of queries to come through closer to the implementation date, seeing that is when many entities are going to get closer to the actual requirements? And then the third issue, you talked about NIFRICS. Yes, there are meeting notes. They're not easy to find. How easy is it going to be for anyone to, in fact, go through the discussions that have been made? Because at the moment, it seems that the only way you can do it is going through the minutes of each meeting.
Well, I'll answer on the TRGs, if you like, Garth, and Henry will tell me when I'm wrong. But do we give direct feedback to people who ask questions? I think unofficially, through the staff, we do. But there are notes of the meetings which note how the issue was discussed and what people thought. So there's a public document out there that everybody can refer to. So I think that was your first point. Your point that there'll be more queries as we come closer to implementation, I understand that point. The other pushback we get is, when are we going to have a stable standard? Are we going to sit there and change it forever? In 2 years' time, when you've got a month to implementation, are we going to put through another amendment and you're going to have another look at your implementation? So we put a lot of emphasis on that stability question, and there comes a point, and remember, these TRGs are by exception. This is not a normal process. So there comes a point, in our opinion, and it's a good debate, where we've got to say enough. and we've got to have a stable standard that people can start working with to get implemented. So that's the balance. We, you know, if something really, really critical came up, we might have to look at it again, but there does come a point in time where you've got to let your constituents get on with implementing. And you want to talk about NIFRICS.
Well, I was going to say something. I think it was actually about the impairment transition resource group. I think it's a similar story, actually. There are meeting notes. It's very clear what was discussed, and very clear what was concluded. It isn't additional guidance, and it isn't an opening up of the standard to say different and new things, but it is giving clarity or gives a clear record of what was discussed.
Do you want to comment on the NIFRIC issue and finding those?
What do I want to say about NIFRICs? I suppose we...
Well, maybe I would just say that if we are going to truly acknowledge those as, if you like, part of the literature, then we do need to think about ensuring that they are accessible. And just leave it at that, unless you want to say something, Henry?
Well, I just make two comments, one relating to Garth's comments about the TRG. So although we do issue a separate meeting report after the end of each meeting, we've also compiled them all into a log. And we can certainly keep thinking about, is there a better way of disseminating the information from the TRG groups? But we've pulled everything together, and then it cross-references to all of the individual meeting reports. And then on the IFRICS agenda decisions, one of the places that captures all of those is actually in the green educational BAM volume. So that puts them all into context. And we also just, with the revenue and the impairment groups, although we've not incorporated in that guidance because, of course, it doesn't go through any due process, we have alerted people in that volume to the existence of those two groups.
Thank you. Jim. Okay, Gavin. Whatever. One of you.
Oh, just on the disclosure initiative, I think you're right. There is an expectation, or maybe it's an expectation gap or not, because certainly when I listen to my members talk, there is a clear expectation that the ISB will be doing a standard-by-standard exercise. And in fact, the commentary I hear is that the ISB is too slow at delivering that. Now, I absolutely accept your point about behaviours, and indeed I often push back to my members. The reality, of course, is it's quite difficult to take disclosures out for all the reasons we've talked about here before. I think, you know, the ISB actually doing something, I guess, let me say, more tangible. It's probably not the right way to say, but at a standards level, I think actually probably has more power from a signalling perspective than from a sort of reality or substance perspective.
I think, you know, to me, when I look at it, and you know, I was a preparer for 12 years, so I understand this subject pretty well too. Back to the point, I don't think we're going to be stripping out 50% of the disclosure requirements. That is not going to happen. But what is happening, and it's this work that we've been doing with the New Zealanders, is we're framing disclosure objectives in a different way and encouraging more judgment to be applied in writing down the message, and it's a little bit touching on this communication point. So I think, you know, it's quite easy, you know, as a preparer to say I would like a standard-by-standard review to cut out all these requirements and my job will become easier. It's not going to happen like that. And it's unrealistic to expect that. Whilst I could understand people might want that. So, yeah, to me, it still comes back to this behavioural change, which can happen now. There's nothing stopping it. There's nothing, you know, the board has made very, very clear that we're in a principles-based world. We expect companies to communicate their story. We're after effective disclosure. We're after judgment. That's all out there fairly and squarely. And I think, you know, yes, we will make some targeted amendments. I think there are things that one can do. But I think we've probably got a small number of problem children on certain standards. So you look at disclosures on share-based payments. On a big group, they go on forever. And you get to the end and you wonder what you've learned. So I think there probably are things that we can do about that. But across the board, we're not going to be slicing great swathes of disclosure requirements out. I don't think it's going to happen.
So, and I certainly think that for the group sitting around this table, the members of the council, to take that back to your geographies, organisations, whatever, around that behaviour change. Because I certainly, as Hugh alluded to, Australia and New Zealand, and certainly the boards that I sit on, and I'm the chair of the audit committee on all of the boards, we have streamlined the accounts in every single circumstance of those boards, because the role I have, I think if anyone's going to do it in New Zealand, I should be taking the lead and working with. There was resistance, I have to say, from some of the auditors to start with. However, so it's actually working together, you know, both the preparers, because it actually is harder to do in some ways, but actually you can do it, and actually it is far more effective communication to the stakeholders of actually giving information and actually the ordering of the financial statements, so that actually the important things are up front. It's communication.
And just to make the point as well, the disclosure problem is a two-sided thing, well, at least a two-sided thing. One of it is excessive use of boilerplate language, but the other bit, and this is a consistent message from users, there isn't enough effective disclosure on things which really are material. So it's a two-sided thing.
And I have to say, linked to this, and I meant to do this right at the beginning, is actually the new auditor's audit report required. And again, I've taken a lead with my companies in New Zealand, and I know in the UK, in fact, some companies have already... It's not required yet, is it, in the UK? But some companies have done it, and certainly in my companies in New Zealand, we have taken a view that although the audit report hasn't been issued this year, we have asked the auditors for all of them to tell us what would be, have been in the audit report, so that we could look at that in every single instance to make absolutely certain that we've got the disclosures as the directors in the company in there, and those are probably the important disclosures. So it comes back to that communication. Sorry, I've gone off the subject here. However, I think it is, the key is that behaviour change, and I'd certainly encourage everyone around here to think about that in going back to your relative places. Now, Jim, you've taken your sign down. No? You want to say something?
With respect to the TRG, I certainly acknowledge that the number of issues has declined, and for the meeting next week, there's not that many, but there are a couple of observations I would make. First of all, PricewaterhouseCoopers put out a report last week around the status of implementation in the U.S., and it wasn't very good, that a lot of companies are not actually very far along in the implementation. So there might be questions that, you know, that will begin to surface as that, as the company, more companies get serious. Secondly, based on my staff's outreach to various groups, industry groups, we do have a concern that the industry groups have identified issues but haven't surfaced them up to the TRG yet. And so I'm expecting that there could be more issues that are going to come from that process as well. Having said that, I think given the emphasis that the large preparers and the profession have put on trying to identify with the big issues that they thought might need standard setting, I'm hoping that's behind us and that the TRG activities from, you know, going forward will be more on trying to get consistent application as opposed to needing to change the standard.
Okay, thanks for that, Jim. Jake.
Thank you. I had a number of sort of unconnected thoughts, so apologies for the possibly slightly rambling group of things I'll suggest. That the first is that as the TRG sort of wind down, a question that occurs to me is are the ISB planning on reviewing the effectiveness of those TRGs and what benefits they've added to consistent application, and whether there's anything of value to be taken from them? I'm assuming there is. Secondly. Once the conceptual framework has been finalised, it occurred to me that it might be sensible to take that and apply that to the problems that currently exist in the research agenda and think about, does that immediately propose any solutions there, and I wondered if that's something the ISB were planning to do. And thirdly, was just a reflection on something Hugh said about there being no barriers around disclosure. I think I would agree at the large end of the market, where there's lots of time and resource and effort put into financial reporting, that there certainly aren't barriers to preparers thinking through how to produce financial statements in a clear, concise, communicative manner. But as you get down into the smaller preparer community, resource becomes a real issue, and more often than not, those smaller preparers just say, what does the standard ask me to disclose? I'm going to disclose that. It's a lot easier than thinking too long and hard about it. So my feedback to you would be, it doesn't remove the need for the ISB to think very, very long and hard about, is this disclosure truly needed, and by whom, and for what purpose?
Do you want to respond to any of those, or just absorb those comments?
The review of the TRGs, I mean, I guess the first thought we would have is whether they were worthwhile or not in the circumstances. These were particular circumstances, revenue such a big topic, and moving to an expected loss model was a big step. Whether those circumstances pertain in the future, we'd need to think about. And the concepts, I think our people in the research area are always thinking about the concepts in terms of the old concepts and proposed new concepts. So I don't see a magic light suddenly shining on all the problems, because I think in all the projects, they're thinking about both the old and the new concepts.
Yeah, just to add to what Ian said about the conceptual framework and the research project, research agenda. One specific case that the board discussed in July was the implications of the proposed new conceptual framework for the work on IS37. And there was quite a detailed paper that explored those implications. And we discussed that with the ASAF as well in September. And clearly we'll do that on other projects where that's appropriate as well.
Final question, Roxana. Comment.
So, first of all, maybe just to support a comment made by Jake on the on an analysis of the use of how much a TRG is needed for a new standard, and perhaps to define exactly what are the circumstances in which that is needed. Second is on the disclosure initiative, and I would like to take this opportunity just to let you know that actually ESMA issued a statement last week on the improving the quality of disclosures in the financial statements. And the reason for doing that, it basically comes from our discussion with our stakeholders, in which we have been told that the regulators are pushing for many disclosures, and actually if the disclosure is not in the financial statements, then an issuer, you know, is scared of getting a reaction from the enforcer. So we thought, and I think I announced that during the ISB conference in June, that we're going to step into this joint effort of trying to make the disclosure more relevant. I'm not going to talk about the size, because I think we're not fulfilling the expectation, but we see, at least in Europe, there are geographies in which actually there are not enough information. There are geographies where, or companies where, there is too much information, and that's why we actually want to focus on the relevance and the consistency, and we think the materiality statement of practice would be useful also in that respect, and obviously we support the ISB project.
Thanks, Rosanna, and I agree, it's all about everyone's behaviour change and being perceived that actually someone's not holding it up, so it's really great that's come up. Now, this session was supposed to include an update on the foundation activities as well. Yale, are there matters that you would like to bring to our attention or cover in that?
Most of it, I think, is more an update. Just one point I'll raise is that we had a very successful meeting last week with IOSCO. As you know, we have a protocol with IOSCO that's up for review after 2 years of functioning, and the purpose of the meeting was, first of all, to exchange our normal views, and second, to review the relationship and see whether we can make it more effective. There were a number of ideas that were raised, which were very good, and we're going to take them forward. The one thing that probably needs to be explored further with IOSCO is the fact that those meetings are not transparent. We can't publicize them at the request of the IOSCO member, and that's quite rare on our side because we normally operate in a completely transparent environment, whereas regulators don't want to share some of this intimate content of consultation because in many cases it raises particular enforcement issues, case-specific, and they don't want to have that very much out in the open. So this is maybe something we need to explore, but I think both sides feel the relationship has been working very efficiently and has benefited both sides. So I think we are probably going to take some drafting amendments, proposals for the trustees meeting, and the IOSCO board would also consider that. So we think, generally speaking, it's a very positive experience.
Thank you, Yael. Abbreviated report. Does anyone have any questions of Yael around the foundation activities and or actually any comments or observations from your perspective of what you've seen around that relationship between the foundation and IOSCO? Would you share, or does anyone disagree with Yael's observations that it appears to have been working well? It would appear not. So your stakeholder constituents are supportive of that view. Okay, that then, unless there is any further comment from anybody sitting at this end of the table or everybody else around the update on the ISB and the foundation activities, I suggest we complete this topic and thank you for those sharing those thoughts as to where we've been going.